Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we have the last in our series of panel discussions organized by the Boston University Department of Journalism on the 2004 presidential campaign, with special emphasis on the Democratic National Convention being held here in Boston this week. Tonight's forum is entitled Campaign 2004, The Democrats and Their Candidate, and begins with an introduction from tonight's moderator, Professor Robert Zelnick, Chairman of the Department of Journalism. Professor Zelnick.
Greetings and welcome to the third and final pre-convention panel sponsored by the Department of Journalism at Boston University. Special welcomes to WBUR, which is again covering the event for its distinguished World of Ideas program, and to C-SPAN, an old friend of our great debates. Welcome. 2 weeks ago, John Kerry chose John Edwards as his running mate. His first choice, of course, had been a well-known figure from Arizona, but as we know, the Diamondbacks refused to send Randy Johnson to Boston. Even so, I predict this was going to be a great convention for us and for anyone else who's able to get to it. Conventions help candidates relate to the common folks. Why, just this morning, I'm told Senator Kerry was driving in his limousine when his chauffeur nearly hit a bicycle. "Be careful," Kerry scolded. "Those things cost $9,000. I thought there was more than one Republican here. I'm sorry. We're told no one watches or cares about these things, as the nomination was decided months ago. In fact, I heard Ted Koppel was thinking of boycotting this one, too, until he heard ABC was going to hire David Letterman to cover it instead. The conventions are the only time, though, that candidates have the virtually uninterrupted opportunity to define both themselves and their opponents. Not always intentionally. Sometimes the message is strong enough to land beyond that famous post-convention bounce the pundits are always describing for us. In 1948, for example, Harry Truman and Albin Barkley, a border state ticket of men born to modest circumstances, projected a quiet strength. They would defend the New Deal against a conservative counterattack, and they would back civil rights against Dixiecrat racism. At the 1960 Democratic Convention in Chicago, JFK, that's Kennedy, not Kerry, defined himself as a man of vision and vigor, images just strong enough to get him past Richard Nixon. In 1964, Barry Goldwater's embrace of extremism in the defense of liberty dug a hole from which he could never escape. In 1968, the bitter Democratic divide over Vietnam put Hubert Humphrey so far behind that he could never quite catch up. And in 1972, after a period of internal reform, Democrats stamped themselves as soft on defense, soft on crime, and intoxicated with quotas, images, whether justified or not, that gave the so-called L-word liberal a bad name for a generation. We have a panel superbly qualified to discuss the Democrats and their candidates, the situation they're in, and how they intend to set the theme for the campaign ahead. We start with a colleague. George Bachrach is a valued colleague here at Boston University, a lawyer, consultant, a man of great idealism. He's a former state legislator and candidate for Congress, and one of the most reflective political commentators I know, though I can't remember the last time we agreed on anything. Alan Solomon, he's an entrepreneur, philanthropist, and political activist, and as the founder and CEO of the ADS Group, ADS, he helped build a broad and innovative network of elder care services. He served as national finance chairman of the Democratic National Committee. He's also chairman of the board of combined Jewish, I think the next word is philanthropies. Let me turn the page. Philanthropies of Greater Boston, and he's rumored to be involved with the Kerry campaign. Governor Michael Dukakis, a distinguished three-term governor of Massachusetts and the 1988 Democratic presidential candidate, has remained a good and vital citizen in the years following his retirement from elective politics. He's been an educator, a health care advocate, and I might add a good and valued neighbor. His academic affiliations have included the Kennedy School, Northeastern, the University of Hawaii, and Florida Atlantic University. Now, I know that Ellen Kmark is not here. I hope she does join us. She's a lecturer in public policy at the Kennedy School. She was one of the founders of the New Democratic Movement, the centrist group that persuaded Democrats that winning elections was nothing to be ashamed of. In the White House during the Clinton years, she helped Al Gore reinvent government and was a powerful and influential member of his 2000 campaign team. Carl Cameron is the chief political correspondent for Fox News. He served in a similar capacity with WMUR-TV in Manchester, New Hampshire, renowned for its coverage of presidential politics. I watch a fair amount of political news on the cables and the networks, and I can tell you that Carl is among the best. So let me begin with Governor Dukakis.
Thanks, Mom, and thank you all very much. First, as I usually say at occasions like this, if I knew anything about presidential politics, I would be here in another capacity. So don't assume I know anything more than you do. And in any event, no two elections are alike. I mean, this one isn't comparable to anyone that I can remember, and so it goes. I think John Kerry is going to win, not just because I trained him in his youth when he was my lieutenant governor, but because I think the degree of dissatisfaction with the Bush administration really runs very deep. Now, part of the problem, and Carl, you might want to comment on this, is that our friends in the national media are poll-obsessed, and they don't know how to read polls. And so we're already inundated with numbers that are relatively meaningless at this point, with one exception. When an incumbent, whether Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative, presidential or otherwise, has been running consistently in the low to mid-40s on re-election. And by the way, that's the important number, not approval. It's his re-election number. And this president has been in the low to mid-40s for months. That incumbent is in very deep trouble. I'm really not interested in Kerry's numbers at this point, nor should you be. It's where is the incumbent? And it isn't that Bush and his campaign couldn't conceivably turn this around in some way. I mean, lots of things happen, and there's no way of predicting what will happen in the next 3 to 4 months. But if I were an incumbent, and George, since you've been in office, you might want to reflect on this, and I were in the now low 40s, I would be very, very concerned, which is one of the reasons why I think you've had this assault on Kerry, and that will continue nonstop, I guess, right through August, even before the Republican convention. I think Kerry made the right decision in picking Edwards. My one concern is that the Kerry-Edwards ticket and the Democrats take advantage of the intensity of feeling among those who don't like Bush in the current administration and use it to develop what is really an unprecedented grassroots operation, which involves citizen volunteers in every one of the 50 states, not just the battleground states, on a precinct-by-precinct basis. Thanks to the Internet, you can do that now for virtually no cost. I'm not talking about using the Internet to connect with voters. I'm talking about a precinct-by-precinct, block-by-block organization of volunteers that literally makes contact with every single voting household in the United States, whether the states are red, blue, purple, or otherwise. And the Kerry-Edwards ticket in the Democratic Party now have the opportunity to do that, to repeat at virtually no cost, thanks to the Internet. Now, efforts to do that are underway. I hope and expect that within the next few weeks that effort will be in place. I'm not talking, again, just about battleground states. I'm talking about every state. This is not only important when it comes to the election. It's important in terms of party building. Now, part of the problem these days is that a lot of the folks that are the so-called consultants, and some of them are good friends of mine, really tend to disparage this kind of grassroots organization. In my opinion, it's even more effective today than it used to be because so few people do it. And the Kerry campaign really has an extraordinary opportunity. He's already got over 1 million campaign contributors. I don't know how many precincts there are, you know, in this country. It could be more than a couple of 100,000. I mean, all those folks potentially are precinct and block captains. And I mean systematically walking the streets, knocking on doors, and making contact with the people of this country who, for the most part, have never had that experience because both major political parties have stopped doing it. This is a great opportunity for the Democrats to start doing it again. And if, in fact, the Kerry campaign puts that operation in place and is serious about it, I think he will win and win decisively. Having said that, this is a very unpredictable world. It's a very unpredictable business. And there's no telling what may happen, but I think their chances are very good. I just want to see that kind of really deep and effective grassroots organization in place as we go into the final.
Let's hear some words from George Bacharach.
Thank you, Bob. I'm delighted to be here. As Bob mentioned, I teach here at Boston University, and the notion of a former politician being able to teach journalism is, I think, the ultimate revenge. And I'm delighted to have that opportunity here. I'm also delighted to be here with such a distinguished panel, in particular Mike Dukakis, who inspired many of us 30 years ago, and it is now 30 years ago, this campaign season, that a lot of us marched on his behalf to try and bring reform to state government, and he led that charge. I might also add that he's been kind enough to come here to BU several times to guest teach classes, which I think many of us here appreciate. I want to spend a few minutes talking about the need for inspiration in politics these days and the lack of it in contemporary politics. But before I do that, I want to jump to the bottom line quickly and concur with Governor Dukakis about the end result. I believe John Kerry will win this election, not because I'm a partisan Democrat, which I am, but because this race will be a referendum on President Bush. It has very little to do with John Kerry, thankfully, since I think this has been a campaign without great inspiration on the Democratic side. But I think it's a referendum on George Bush, and I think he will lose by a larger margin than most people predict or any of the polls predict, not because of Democrats, but largely because those that agree with George Bush on the critical issues of the time will find him wanting. That is to say, those that agreed with him on the invasion of Iraq, agreed with him, will ultimately say, we were with you on the war, but where's the peace? And those who were with him on economic policy like the tax cut will say, thank you, President Bush, for the tax cut, but where again are the jobs and the rebounding economy? And if he loses even a small percentage of those who were with him on those issues, which I believe he will lose by a substantial margin this fall. And that is his dilemma, in my view. But let me touch briefly on the notion of political inspiration. In 1948, at the Democratic Convention, the Democrats decided to add a civil rights plank to the platform. And there was much debate about whether to add it or not, in large part because they feared that Strom Thurmond and the Dixiecrats would march out the door, and they threatened to do so. And a young Minnesota mayor named Hubert Humphrey stood up and said, let them walk. This party has to stand for something. And so it did, and they walked, and the Democratic Party stood for something. And 20 years later, many of us got involved in politics because in 1968, there was a presidential candidate by the name of Bobby Kennedy who had the right blend of passion and intellect and commitment, and he turned us on. He inspired us, and we marched with him. And I think in the last many years, there's been a slow erosion of ideology and passion and a commitment to basic principles that I think has alienated most of America. So that today I believe that most Americans are no longer Democrats or Republicans or liberal or conservative. They yearn for courage and independence and blunt talk, and they get little of it. And we ought to learn the lesson, in my view, the lesson of John McCain and the lesson of Howard Dean, who excited people because they spoke so bluntly. What made John McCain, who I would never have voted for, I'm always amazed at my Democratic friends who think, you know, he ought to be on the ticket or he ought to be part of what we're doing. We disagree with him, but his strength was He would criticize the NEA one day and the NRA the next day. And so he was perceived as an honest broker and a reformer, and that was important in American politics. And Howard Dean, likewise, with his fire and his challenge to the war and to what the establishment was doing in Washington, also became an inspiration. The problem we have is that most candidates who speak this way are either dark horse candidates who are liberated or candidates who can no longer win and are liberated. Ted Kennedy in 1980 gave the best speech of his failing political campaign in Georgetown when he knew he could no longer win. And it was a call for progressive and liberal values. It was an anthem for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, but it came when he could no longer win. And so it has been in many campaigns since then. And I worry and I fear for this democracy because we need to attract more people, particularly more young people, to this cause. And yet our candidates are now so paralyzed by consultants and pollsters who tell them to offend no one and therefore offer little, to gear their campaign to a very narrow band of undecideds in swing states. And think of who those undecideds must be. They must be the strangest, most bizarre, ignorant, uninformed people in America if they don't have a point of view on this campaign at this late stage. And yet that's what American politics is now geared to. So I worry. I hope that John Kerry, who I've known for almost 30 years, I was hired by him into the district attorney's office in Middlesex County in 1979. He is a far better person than this campaign would indicate. He will be a far better president than this campaign will allow him to be. But my hope is that the vision and the courage that we saw from John Kerry in the 70s will resurface somewhere in the next 3 or 4 months. Mike Dukakis, who I admire and would have made a great president, once said one thing that I frankly disagreed with in 1988 when he said it is competence and not ideology. It must be competence and ideology. There is no reason to be in this business of politics if you don't have an ideology, if you don't have a point of view. And while, again, I believe George Bush will lose because of George Bush, my hope is that at some point in this next few weeks that John Kerry emerges and gives us something to actually vote for. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Bachrach. Just a footnote, I remember the Kennedy announcement in 1980 that he was going to speak at Georgetown, and it was widely speculated in the press that he was going to use the occasion to withdraw from the contest because he had gotten beaten so badly, beginning with New Hampshire, right across the country to Illinois. And after that speech, he really turned the momentum around and didn't come within an eyelash of getting the nomination, but made it very, very respectable. Let me call next on Alan Solomont, and we'll go from there. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't teach. And the only office I've ever held was I was vice president of the eighth grade at the Edith C. Baker School, which is the same grammar school that Michael Dukakis went to. And I'm flattered to be up here with some of my political heroes. I'm also the only one that wrote down what he might say. I also know I'm here not as a representative of the Kerry campaign, but as an observer. So I just want you to know that the Kerry tie that I'm wearing is a fashion statement. It's not a political one. My first experience with presidential politics was as a page at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. I remember trying to cozy up to a state representative from Brookline and who was more interested in his New York Times than in talking to a young page, that named Michael Dukakis, but I forgave him for that. At the time, this country was fighting an unpopular war. We had an economy that was failing to meet the aspirations of all of our citizens, and we were a nation divided. So the more things change, the more they stay the same. This is my fifth presidential campaign, and over these years, I have come to postulate certain consistent themes in presidential politics, sort of rules that seem to pop up at each election. which actually I think are being bent or broken this year. And so I just wanted to highlight a couple of things that I think are different about the 2004 election. First, that the notion that a Northeast liberal from Massachusetts can be elected president, which in some of the popular media is an idea that gets disparaged. And, of course, I agree with the two earlier speakers that I think, in fact, we will elect a Northeast liberal from Massachusetts as president. It's an interesting phenomenon, which is the role that Massachusetts plays in presidential politics. I think we have a much more profound involvement in that than people realize. Every Democratic senator since John Kerry from Massachusetts has been a candidate for president. The state has produced 5 candidates for president, which is probably more than any other state in the country, save maybe for Texas, where I guess you can run exclusively on ideology and not at all on competence. And in fact, one of the things that's encouraging about this year is how deep we are with Massachusetts talent. If you look at the senior leadership of the Kerry campaign, there are many people who, one, have trained in the come out of Massachusetts politics, many of whom really came out of this man's organization, John Sasso, Michael Hooley, Mary Beth Cahill, Bob Farmer. And there are also people who have been in winning presidential campaigns. In 1988, one of the disadvantages we had was that Bush 41 had scores of senior managers in the campaign who had experience in more than one successful presidential campaign. That was in part because the White House was, to some extent, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican Party from 1968 to 1992, with one exception. And the Dukakis campaign, frankly, had – I don't think they had anyone in a senior role who had been in a successful presidential campaign. And that has changed, and I think that is serving us very well in the Kerry campaign. A few other rules. Presidential politics is played in the middle of the field. I think that Bill Clinton showed us in 1992 that he was able to end the lock that the Republicans had on the party by moving the center of gravity of the Democratic Party more into the middle. But in fact, if you look at the way the Bush campaign has governed and is running, they're really playing to their base. They started out talking about, compassionate conservative, uniter, not divider, no child left behind. The only thing that they've united are Democrats. And in fact, they really have continued to, through policies about stem cell research or the Supreme Court, their court judicial choices, et cetera, have really been running, I think, to the far right. Second rule has been that the most valuable asset in politics is an enemy, and that negativity works. We certainly learned that the hard way in 1988 when unfairly the Bush campaign maligned the person to my left. And in fact, I think the Gingrich revolt in 1994 was based upon going after both Clintons, not only Bill but Hillary. And in fact, I think President Clinton won re-election in 96 by running negatively against the Contract for America and specifically Newt Gingrich and Bob Dole. But in this campaign, after spending $80 million after Super Tuesday in the battleground states, 90% of which was negative advertising against Kerry, trying to define Kerry disparagingly, trying to land a knockout punch early in the general election campaign. If you look at the numbers in the battleground states after that onslaught of negative advertising, you'll see that George Bush's approvals actually went down in the battleground states and John Kerry's went up. And so I think the American people may have had their fill of that kind of negative campaigning and that we're going to see we're certainly seeing a more positive campaign on our side. The next rule is it's the economy, stupid. I remember being at a campaign briefing in the year 2000 when Elaine Kmark made the observation that probably the most important element in a president's job description is to represent the United States in the community of nations, and yet that's the least important element in a presidential campaign. We certainly saw that in 2000. But in fact, I think this year it's national security, stupid. And I think the reason that John Kerry is our nominee is the fact that Democrats saw that he could win because he really could go up against the Republicans on the issue of national security, on the issue of foreign policy, that his credentials as a soldier and as a war hero really distinguished him and differentiated him as a candidate. Money talks. My role is a fundraiser. I'm finance chairman, New England finance chairman of the Kerry campaign, and I was never smart enough or good-looking enough to do anything else, but I'm a pretty good fundraiser, so that's typically my role. And I think probably know a fair amount about the role of money in politics. And what we've seen here is that a changing role in that. I mean, Dean didn't win the nomination despite having a huge financial advantage in the primaries. We've always thought that Republicans have a huge advantage, that we'd be outspent 2 or 3 to 1. But historically, the Democrats have had no money to spend between the primaries and the convention. But in fact, this year, the Bush campaign's raised $215 million, while the Kerry campaign has raised $180 million, and has raised 150 of that since in 2004, most of which we've raised since March 2nd. That's a lot of money. But of the $150 million, $100 million of it has come from grassroots donors, from the Internet, from telemarketing, from direct mail, and 50 from the sort of major donor camp. Compare that to 1996, when the Democratic National Committee raised $126 million for Bill Clinton's reelection. $26 million was from the grassroots. $100 million was from major donors. And of the $100 million, $20 million came from 168 individual donors who gave $100,000 or more. So the role of money and the way it's raised has changed, and I guess sooner or later I'll become a dinosaur. Last point, which is the role of television. And this speaks a little bit to Michael's point. The great sucking sound in American politics over the last couple of decades has been the role of paid advertising. It's really driven presidential politics, I believe, beginning in the 80s and certainly in the 1990s. I think that the 2004 election is going to be won or lost on the ground. We saw glimpses of it in 2000. We certainly saw it in the 2002 midterm elections. And in fact, what we saw is that the Republican parties cleaned our clock in 2002 because they mobilized their base better than we did. And even in Massachusetts, I think the last gubernatorial election was somewhat driven by that. But television doesn't reach people the way it used to, and it's a much more fragmented, and technology has allowed us to tailor our message much more individually. And I guarantee you that the Democrats are going to invest in the biggest field operation in the history of the party and the history of presidential politics. And so I think will the Republicans. But I think that our ability to mobilize our base and to capture the enthusiasm and excitement is really one of the reasons that we are going to be successful in November. And I would say this about the generations. We lost a generation in American politics, the generation after ours. Somehow the folks that followed us middle-aged men and women were turned off to it. If we owe George Bush a great debt of gratitude because he has mobilized a generation of young people the way they haven't been mobilized before. And the last point I make is the way we treat money people. At the last forum that I was invited to speak about presidential politics was at the Wellfleet Public Library in 2000. So the fact that I'm here at the BU School of Journalism with such a distinguished panel indicates that we do believe that people who raise money know more about politics than might be apparent. So I thank you for having me on this panel.
In point of fact, what it reflects is that we want you to raise money for us.
I would not know how.
Elaine Tamar.
Thank you for letting me be a couple minutes late. I was in a traffic jam, as usual. Many of you will sympathize with that.
Well, you've got to start riding the T more faithfully around here, don't you think?
Because no,
I got here on time on the green
line. There's no T from Cape Cod, Michael.
There should be.
There should be, yes. That's for sure. I want to actually talk about competence and ideology, because I came in when George was talking about this. Theme from Michael Dukakis's 88 campaign, and it was something I was thinking about a lot. The Bush administration is a triumph of ideology over competence. Extreme, passionate ideology is actually pretty damn dangerous in the government, and we see it in this administration. We saw a team beginning with Cheney going to Rumsfeld, to Wolfowitz, and to Doug Feith in the Pentagon, who consistently ignored counter evidence about Iraq, who consistently refused to do post-war planning in Iraq. My father-in-law was military government in the Second World War. He was military government in Italy. He was military government in Germany. They were planning what happened when they took over these countries for years before the actual invasion. It's staggering to him as a World War II veteran. It's staggering to anybody who knows about taking over a country that we did no such planning. Why? Because this was ideology run amok. This was a group of people who actually believed their own chatter about how the Iraqis, because they lived under a dictator, were going to welcome us with open arms. There were plenty of dissenting views. Many of those dissenting views came from the CIA. Many of them, if anyone cared to look, could have been known. This was knowable. This was not a big secret. The CIA, in fact, in the run-up to the war, was leaking like a sieve, as we say in Washington, about the counter, the doubts about this, and the doubts particularly about the post-war planning. So I give you a warning as young people that ideology, particularly extreme ideology, passionately believed in, the kind of ideology which will get Republican partisans up on their feet and cheering, can be a pretty dangerous thing, particularly when it is paired with a lack of competence or a desire to please the leaders and the people in charge with no regard for what the alternative facts seem to be or the alternative scenario seems to be. I am distrustful of ideology. I am distrustful of ideology in the highest reaches of the American government. We have a huge role in the world, and the President of the United States needs to be constantly looking at this changing world and figuring out what is the right thing to do for the United States of America. And what is the right thing to do, frankly, for the world? Because if you've ever been in any of these other countries or conferences like the ones they hold every year in Davos, one of the things you see is a real schizophrenia about the United States. On the one hand, they don't sort of like us, and they kind of distrust us, and they're resentful. And yet, on the other hand, they always want to know, why aren't you leading on this? They look to us because we are the only ones that can lead. This administration has failed to step up to the complexities of power. And I think that the Democrats have a much, much better handle on this because, in fact, they have a much mushier ideology. Okay, let's face it. They have an ideology that's kind of about multilateralism in their foreign relations. We have a respect for multiculturalism. I don't think there's any piece of the Democratic Party that could take over the Pentagon or take over some piece of the United States government and impose upon it an ideological view of the world in the way that the neocons took over the Bush administration, much to the detriment of the United States of America, not to mention the men and women who've given their lives in this war. So I want to go back to Michael Dukakis and say there's a lot to be said for competence. There's a lot to be suspicious about ideology. And I think that that's where we need to think in this election. I am thoroughly unimpressed by those who talk about John Kerry being boring. I could care less whether John Kerry was boring or not. What I want to know is, can he run the country in a sensible way where every day he does what Bill Clinton did every day, get up and think about what's best for the American people? You know, Bill Clinton, I always say there's the bad good Bill Clinton and the good Bill Clinton, right? The bad Bill Clinton is the one who they still make jokes about on the late night shows. The good Bill Clinton was the guy who had a profound sense of public morality, even though his personal morality left a bit to be desired. And his public morality consisted of not having on ideological blinders, but deciding what was in the best interests of the country every day. So even though he was a Democratic president with a lot of labor union backing, he said, steel quotas, bad idea. Europe will probably retaliate against all sorts of other American industries. In the whole, this was bad for the United States. So he didn't let his ideology blind him for what was right for the country. He, in fact, opposed steel quotas. And, of course, we know what happened when the Bush administration went for steel quotas. The EU threatened all sorts of retaliation against all sorts of other industries in the United States, including among them, which was very smart, Florida oranges. That was hitting home. And because of Brother Jim. And so this is a perfect example of thinking of what was right about the country and putting aside ideology. When the world is changing faster than we can possibly imagine, ideology can be pretty dangerous. And I just urge you, as you're looking at this election, to be suspicious of it, because we have seen a prime example of an administration dominated by two disastrous ideologies. One, the neocon view of what's right in the Middle East, and secondly, the absolute belief in tax cutting as a solution to all economic problems, which we know has been a failure and will be mortgaging your future for many, many years to come. So that's my word of caution to add to those who've spoken so well, and I will end.
Thank you, Lee. Carl?
Great to be here. Thanks for the invitation. I'm Carl Cameron, and for a while I lived here. I was a student at the BU Business School for a while and lived in Alston and Brighton and Coolidge Corner and Cleveland Circle and all the cheesy little apartments that all of you are renting right now. My mom was involved heavily with the Massachusetts League of Women Voters and will be pleased to death to see me on the stage here with Governor Dukakis, because she was a big participant in his campaign back in 88, and I went up to New Hampshire after that. And it's very interesting. And talking about the sort of Massachusetts dynasty in presidential politics, I got started in presidential politics covering it as a reporter in New Hampshire. And, of course, it's got the first-in-the-nation primary. But what a lot of people don't realize is there are a tremendous amount of Massachusetts political operatives, regardless of who the candidate might be, whether it's John Kerry or Michael Dukakis or anybody else, who every 4 years rent cheesy little apartments in southern New Hampshire and get involved in the campaigns up there. So there's an awful lot of folks in Massachusetts politics on both sides of the aisle that people in New Hampshire deal with all the time. And Massachusetts, even if it's not candidates, has always blessed the country with a very, very large number of influential political operatives. I want to associate myself with a lot of what's said here. I agree with a great deal of it. In talking about the polarization of this race, we hear about how close the polls are and how it's likely to go down to the very last minute, and it'll be an organizational battle, and who can get out their field organizations and their grassroots the best. Perhaps we forget sometimes, and it's worth reminding everybody, that this thing was guaranteed to be incredibly polarized and nasty, regardless of who the candidates were this time around, because of what happened last time around. The backdrop to this is a dead tie that was disputed. And there are an awful lot of people around the country who feel as though they were wronged, and an awful lot of people around the country who think, no, it went right, and those who think it were wrong are just being silly. And that creates a partisanship that really is a big part of the backdrop here that we shouldn't overlook. It was going to be tough from the beginning. Nationally, demographically, in the general polls, as Governor Dukakis said, it looks like it's even, but that can be misleading. Some people will argue that the most important poll is the president's job approval number, which is not going particularly well for George Bush right now. Others will argue that the number one important issue is whether it's strong leadership in his polls. That's a quite high number by comparison. But as the governor pointed out, the other one is the favorabilities in the reelect number. And the reelect number for George W. Bush is troubling. The Republicans know it. They're worried about it. And because of that, they have determined that their course of action is to annihilate the opposition. As you've heard here, a lot of the Democratic support is not necessarily affirmative for John Kerry. It's against George Bush. And whether or not it is politically savvy and successful to court that as a Democratic strategy, it remains to be seen. We're going to find out in the next few days that George Bush has a second-term domestic agenda. So he's going to offer up something else to the electorate beyond just his view that John Kerry is ill-equipped to be the commander-in-chief. Bob was talking about convention apathy, and just as a journalist, I want to say it's really too bad that an awful lot of the media is making a business decision to not cover the convention in depth and justifying it with an editorial statement. They say, oh, look, there's no news here, so we're not going to cover it. Well, they're not covering it in large measures. It's very expensive. And there is news here, and you can make a comparison that goes something along the analysis that everybody in this business does about TV ads. A 30-second bio ad is nothing more than how the candidate would like to be perceived. And every single news network and every newspaper analyzes them and reports on them ad nauseum. Pardon the pun. The point being, if it's worth doing news about a 30-second ad, and it's to all stagecraft, it's probably worth doing news about a convention, which, whether or not it is stagecraft, says a great deal about how a party would like to be perceived, what things they think are important, what things they'd rather not talk about, how they intend to deal with some of the perceived liabilities, as well as how they plan to advance the strength. So there's a tremendous amount of valuable information here, and because a lot of the nation has not tuned in, it's an opportunity for them to hear things. The polarization of this country, you look at the polls now, it says 92% of Democrats have made up their mind of voting for Kerry. 92-94% of Republicans say they're voting for Bush. It does not leave a lot of room for wiggling in the coast-to-coast popular vote race. For those of you who are sports fans, if you watch football and you watch the Patriots, they don't decide they're going to play easy when they're going for short yardage. They still fight hard. Both sides in this race feel as though, and they must feel this way, as though they have a moral obligation to do everything they possibly can to win. Republicans feel that way. Democrats feel that way. That leads to cheating. That leads to nastiness. That leads to polarization. It leads to partisanship and everything else. But they can't do anything else. Because if you don't win, you can't change the world. And that's how they view it. And that's one of the reasons why it gets so nasty. The campaign process tends to sort of take a candidate and peel away layers like an onion. And at the end of the process, one hopes that the essence of the man and the essence of the message is left there for voters to actually take a look at. The advertisement and the political analysis, et cetera, falls on deaf ears if nobody pays attention. We have got so much committed electorate right now that the courtship of the undecideds has become a science, a political science that we've not seen before. It is true that the vast majority of the American people haven't seen an ad yet, unless they've been watching on the news. They're only running in 17 to 20 states. So people in California, people in New York City, unless they see it on cable television, but they're certainly not seeing it on their local advertising. And again, because of how close it is, it's going to be all the tougher, fought all the more aggressively. You'll hear in the final 10 days of this campaign that the winner will be determined by who has the best field organization and grassroots get out the vote effort. And because of how close it is and because of the millions of dollars that are being spent in this exercise. And both campaigns will say that. Their strategists will say that. The consultants will say that. The pundits will say that. Then the election will happen, and someone will win, probably not as close as it was in 2000, at least in the Electoral College, likely. And everybody will turn around and say, ah, John Kerry won, if he does, because Iraq went bad and George Bush did not qualify for rehiring. Or they'll say, George Bush won, because John Kerry wasn't an adequate alternative, and notwithstanding the animosity towards George W. Bush, he had been too damaged in the campaign process for people to see him as a viable alternative. So you'll hear about, oh, it's all about organization until there's a vote, and then we'll assign it and say, here's what really happened and why. And it'll be, of course, a combination of both, because getting people to the votes, getting people to the polls allows them to then make their decision and put a real political and ideological purpose to their vote. The issue of money and the vast amount raised raises a heck of a lot of questions about what the point of campaign finance reform was a couple of years ago. We have shifted the money around, but we've heard all these records being shattered, and it's still out there. Maybe it's not quite as associated directly with special interest money and soft money because now it's hard money, but there's still a tremendous amount, and that's always worth noting. And finally, there are a couple of reports that have been put out that tag John Kerry and John Edwards as, quote, most liberal. Those reports are subject to some debate, whether or not it's a fair assessment of John Kerry and John Edwards, historically speaking. But it is probably true that the Bush administration is one of the most, if not the most, conservative Republican administration that the nation has seen in some time. And John Kerry and John Edwards can be painted as among the most liberal. That, again, plays to the polarity. That, again, plays to the need to fight to the Dickens for that short yardage, which means this is going to be a very, very nasty race. It already is. It will continue to be so. I made a bunch of other notes here. Oh, and on the question of polls, since the governor actually said I want to talk about that, I absolutely agree there's too much emphasis on polls. It's a shortcut. It was determined that Howard Dean was going to be the Democratic nomination 4 months before a vote was cast. And in a similar panel to this up in New Hampshire, I was with a bunch of folks. I said, listen, you know, Howard Dean may have a huge advantage right now, but landing on the polls and relying on the polls is a recipe for disaster. I was saying that, frankly, because I'm a New Hampshire partisan, and I was waiting for the New Hampshire primary medicine to be delivered to whoever is the front runner 3 months out, and of course it was. But the truth of the matter is, for those of you who are going to be journalists or political scientists on the other side of the fence from those of us who report on it, don't ever be surprised by the surprises. Because we don't know what's going to happen. It's going to go down to the wire. The popular vote and all of these polls, frankly, don't matter. It's an electoral college, state-by-state contest. Everybody knows that George Bush is going to win Texas and John Kerry is going to win Massachusetts. You divide up the states where they're pretty clear, and you're left over with between 15 and 20 so-called battleground states where each of those states, in the polls at least, are within the margin of error 4 to 6, 7 points, close enough that either one could win. That's why they're getting all the advertising. And in those states, most of them are fairly demographically representative of the rest of the country. And you have microcosmic reflections of the nation in places like Ohio and Michigan and Florida, et cetera, et cetera. Will the popular vote be close? Probably. Will the Electoral College vote be close? That depends on where they spend their money and what the issues are in the next 4 months, and we're not going to be sure. The economy and the war certainly are pervasive. We found out yesterday that there can be things related to those in the nature of Sandy Berger that can throw a monkey wrench into stuff. That story is probably not going to be particularly impactful, but it gives an example of how this stuff can turn on a dime in ways that neither candidate or campaign expect, and you got to be prepared for those. Every time a reporter is surprised by something, you got to take a look at where the preconceived notion was that made you think that that wasn't going to happen in the first place. Thanks.
I would like to take advantage of the presence of Governor Dukakis to ask you with some specificity to define what would make you pleased with the work of the convention. What does that convention have to do for the Kerry Edwards ticket for you to regard it as successful?
Bob, it has to do two things. By the way, just to set the record straight, because I'm kind of in agreement with George and Elaine on what they've said, even if you think it's a little, there's a contradiction there. After my acceptance speech, in which I said this is not about ideology, it's about competence, the next phrase was, it's about values. A word which is now being tossed around with abandon. So I want you all to kind of reflect on that maybe after I leave. It's not about ideology. It's about competence. It's about values. Yes, it's about competence. I agree with Elaine. Look out for ideologues on both sides. They get us into trouble. But values, commitment, passion, these are very important things in politics and in government. I think, Bob, the convention, if it's done right, and may I say this also, I don't want to keep editorializing, but frankly, I think these security plans are lunacy. I mean, I don't know what's going on out there. I think we're so over the top on security, it's ridiculous. I mean, the terrorists are turning us into a police state in spite of ourselves, and I just, there's got to be some balance here, folks. I know there's a risk out there, but I want this to be a celebration for Boston and for New England. Not something which is such a pain in the neck that people don't want to come to town. This is ridiculous, and I'm delighted that you guys are going to be all over it, and I hope you have a terrific time and enjoy it. I think the convention has to do two things, Bob. First, it obviously gives John Kerry and John Edwards, but Kerry in particular, an opportunity to begin the campaign in chief with the kind of statement that not only is strong and persuasive, but it will be to the biggest audience, he said, so far. And one of the things, as a candidate, and, you know, these campaigns are interminable. I mean, pity the poor candidates. I mean, how would you like to try to say the same thing seven times for 16 months? And the campaign is just beginning. But I think in a way that I didn't quite appreciate, Bob, even after all the work you've done, 30 to 40% of the electorate really don't know John Kerry. Sounds kind of crazy, doesn't it? But they don't. Now, that's a huge opportunity for him. It's also a challenge.
So his appearance, his speech, the coverage of that speech, and by the way, what happens immediately afterwards? The Clinton-Gore bus tours that began right out of the New York Convention, Elaine, I thought was one of the best things they ever did. And by the way, they were so successful that they began doing them 2 or 3 days every week after that. It isn't just the convention, but it's the message plus what happens in the days afterwards. It's very important. And secondly, it's an opportunity for the candidate and for the party to energize the faithful and to send them back out to do the kind of grassroots job that we've been talking about. And that's what you want from a campaign of this kind, a very strong, persuasive, theme-framing message delivered well from the candidate. And this kind of energy and okay, let's go out and do it, which a good convention should produce. We'll see.
Former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis. You've been listening to the last in our series of panel discussions organized by the Boston University Department of Journalism on the 2004 presidential campaign, with special emphasis on the Democratic National Convention being held here in Boston this week. Tonight's forum was entitled Campaign 2004, The Democrats and Their Candidate, and featured former Governor Dukakis, political strategist and former Massachusetts State Senator George Bachrach, Democratic fundraiser and Kerry campaign advisor Alan Solomon, and former Gore campaign advisor Elaine Kmark. Moderating our series of discussions was Professor Robert Zelnick, chairman of Boston University's Department of Journalism. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Kim Skog. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.